As I speak, it is illegal recreation in 2 states, a medicine in 20 states, and has been declared less dangerous than booze by the former chum ganger, now President Barack Obama. Thus, it appears as though cannabis is on its way to normal. And so we ask, what will we reap when we sow cannabis normalica?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 953rd edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio and the GCN Radio Network. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Drummondville who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Aaron Shore on the boards. Aaron, hello.
Hello there.
Listen, Aaron, what do you think is going to happen when we again have legalized cannabis out there growing everywhere? What are we going to reap?
Good question.
Well, good questions is what we up to today. Folks, when cannabis was normal, it was ubiquitous, which is to say it was grown everywhere by pretty much everyone for just about every possible reason. But in 1937, the United States outlawed cannabis and then sealed the deal by talking the world's other governments into signing the Single Convention Treaty of 1961, thus binding the whole world into this prohibition. In doing so, the United States made a plant that was thoroughly normal throughout the world into a plant that was not only abnormal and illegal, but perversely enough, wildly popular, thus leaving the entire world in a state best described as something like reefer madness. But wait, that plant the United States made illegal throughout the world is now a legal recreation, at least sort of, in 2 states, a medicine in 20 states, and was declared to be less dangerous than booze by the former chum ganger, now President Barack Obama. No matter how we look at cannabis, it appears as though the plant is working its way back to being normal in the country that made it abnormal. This very interesting state of affairs leads us to ask, what will we reap when we once again sow cannabis normalica? Here to help us smoke out an answer, we have Eric Altieri, who is the communications director for the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, which, of course, we all know as NORML. Eric, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks for having me on, Michael.
Pleasure to have you aboard. Those in the know, Eric, know there are 3 members of the genus Cannabis. One is Sativa, the other is Indica, and then finally Ruderalis. Today I've taken some literary license and created a whole new member of that genus, Cannabis normalica. And that would be the cannabis that grows normally. NORML has been working to get cannabis to grow normally for a long time, has it not?
That's correct. Just over 40 years now. NORML was founded in 1970, and we've been going strong ever since. And certainly the most exciting time for us really has been the last several years here, where we've seen an explosion of not just interest but support to treat marijuana in the way that we treat alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Well, Eric, we always ask our guests who paves the way. So how does NORML survive for 40 years in this world of advocating the legalization or the normalization of something that was once normal everywhere?
Well, it certainly wasn't easy, but since we were formed, NORML has long been almost entirely funded off of grassroots donations.
So to speak, right?
So to speak, indeed. Usually it's just individuals donating $50 or less, everyday cannabis consumers, or just folks who want to see the end of prohibition. Have long supported NORML, and we've really gotten by with just support from the masses and no need for any sort of billionaire beneficiary in the background.
Good enough. Well, Eric, you know, at one time, or at least for almost all of human history, cannabis was very much normal, and it was indeed grown just about everywhere by just about everyone for all kinds of different purposes. But then we made it illegal, but I forgot why. Why did we make it illegal?
Well, you really have to kind of dig back and look at the history around the 1930s to see the climate that kind of produced this. A lot of it was really based off of racism and negative attitudes towards not just immigrants, but also the African-American community at the time. The government really, particularly Henry Anslinger, who would head up what was would eventually become the DEA, he really took it as his personal mission to kind of stamp out marijuana use, which he saw as a bit of a fringe issue and something that was associated with violence and people of color. And he really used that as a scare tactic to kind of get middle America and white America to begin to fear this otherwise usually rather harmless plant, and started the whole horror campaign with Reefer Madness and really embedded that propaganda in the national mindset.
Well, I think there was another element, too, or I might be wrong, but I'll pass it by you and see if there was any truth to that. I understand that Harry Anslinger was also a revenuer during Prohibition, and that as the Prohibition waned and was phased out of the country, Harry Anslinger and his confederates were kind of looking at a world in which they would have no job.
Oh, absolutely. Coming to the end of alcohol prohibition, Henry Anslinger kind of felt a bit threatened. He saw that he may lose his funding. His organization was losing kind of their central purpose. And they needed really a new boogeyman to threaten the United States with to continue their existence, really. So he looked around and he saw the use of marijuana kind of beginning to grow a little bit around this time, and he saw a real opportunity there to kind of strike and create a new menace that would continue to warrant not only his job but the existence of his entire organization.
Well, I think you touched on this, but you know, in looking back, you've got to think, how on earth could you take something so ubiquitous that it was grown by the gazillions of acres across the country and turn it into something that was so terrifyingly bad?
Well, you know, it also has a lot to do with, how people obtained their information at the time. There certainly was no internet or social media to allow free access for to scientific data and more unbiased sources. So people really had to rely on, the newspapers at the time and whatever talking points were coming out of the federal government. They were very limited in their ability to seek out their own data on this stuff. So, and a lot of those newspapers, particularly through the Hearst Corporation, they didn't particularly really like marijuana to begin with, particularly hemp, which they saw as threatening to, the paper supply that a lot of them were vested in. So it wasn't super familiar of a substance to the American public really at the time. It was really just beginning to grow in the United States itself, despite being rather ubiquitous worldwide for thousands of years. The recreational use was really beginning to take off. So he kind of capitalized on people's ignorance, really, surrounding the cannabis plant.
Mm-hmm. Back up a little bit and talk a little bit about the Hearst Corporation's paranoia of hemp. Why would they be paranoid of hemp?
Well,
which of course, is just another word for cannabis.
Yes, hemp is the non-psychoactive strain of cannabis. It has below 3% THC, so in reality, you can't possibly ever smoke enough of it to really get any sort of high off of it. It's mostly used for industrial products, and we see that used across the world today, from food products, health products, to drywall, to biodiesel, to paper products. And it's a really cheap and easy resource to replace a lot of things that we use paper for, which people like Hearst and others were deeply invested in the paper and timber industries. So they saw hemp as a cheap alternative that could really hurt their monopoly on that.
And thus they had a financial incentive to go after it. Let me ask you this then. What happened when they made cannabis illegal here in the United States? Because it wasn't illegal any other place. It was illegal here. What happened to the whole notion of cannabis among the population?
Well, they began to, most Americans really kind of took Anslinger and his friends at their word and began to kind of fear it. And, prior to the United States itself enacting the Marijuana Tax Act, which was one of the first marijuana prohibition laws in the country in 1937, a few other states began to act on this on their own. You saw a handful of states across the country begin to enact their own state-level prohibition of marijuana. And that began to trickle up. And as soon as the United States really picked up this policy, we then, around the 1960s, with the single Convention on Narcotics Treaty at the United Nations really foisted this prohibition upon the world, and all signatories of that treaty, which is a quite a few nations, are now signed on, and they're required by the wording of that treaty to maintain a prohibition on drugs, including marijuana. So we really kind of broke the whole world into joining us on that one.
And we used cannabis rope, probably, to do it. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Eric Altieri, the Communications Director for the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, and you. You are invited to participate today. We wonder what you think will happen when we once again sow cannabis normalica into our world. Phone number is 800-624-2665. It's 800-624-2665 or 831-479-1080. Cannabis normalica, where will it take us? Right back after these important messages.
Get this. You can earn a 5, 6, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, what do you think out there we will get when we once again sow cannabis normalica? It will be legal. It will be ubiquitous. It will be everywhere. Everyone will grow it for all kinds of different reasons. Will we reap a pleasant recreation? How about a plethora of mental defaults? How about a plentitude of new agricultural commodities? All kinds of things could happen. What do you think will happen? We've got Eric Altieri here with us today on the Food Chain. He is the Communications Director for the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, Normal. So we named a new strain of marijuana after the Normal today. It's Cannabis Normalica. What will happen when we also Cannabis Normalica again? Eric, you know, you talked about the Single Convention Treaty of 1961, in which the United States roped all the rest of the government, or most of the rest of the governments of the world, together and into this situation where we would no longer grow cannabis for all of the things that we were growing it for. Perversely enough, because of all of this, that prohibition, we have focused the attention of the world's consumers on one use of the cannabis plant. And because of that focused interest, we've really changed the nature of that plant, have we not?
We really tried to. It was particularly into the 1930s. It was even listed in the United States Pharmacopoeia, which is the guidebook for medicines. It was the guidebook for medicines in this country. It really wasn't thought of as much of anything, and prior to then, all research that had been conducted shown it to be, you know, relatively safe, very few harms associated with it. It was shown to have a variety of well-meaning purposes, from medicine to industrial purposes. And then that really changed with the 1930s and the scare tactics that began with Reefer Madness and began to turn it from, you know, a everyday plant that had a multitude of positive uses to a bit of a demon drug that was meant to scare the American populace.
But it didn't really scare the American populace when it got right down to it. It seemed to call attention to it. And because of that, what once was a, you know, mild intoxicant has been bred up to be an incredibly potent intoxicant, right?
Well, to a degree, and I think it's important to note that marijuana itself is not technically an intoxicant. By definition, an intoxicant has a level of toxicity to it, a bit of a, you know, an inverse effect on the body. Marijuana produces its effect by binding with a system called the endocannabinoid system, which all mammals are born with, and it really helps regulate a lot of the body's everyday processes. So it's not necessarily an intoxicant per se. But yes, you know, it got a very bad name through the early years, the 30s through the 40s and 50s. But then it was when, in the 1960s and 70s, the counterculture really began to pick up on it, and particularly through the anti-Vietnam War movement, that it really began to become prevalent more in everyday culture, and people began to really question these drug laws we had, which is when you see the advent of both the marijuana law reform movement in general and Normal specifically around 1970.
Well, and those were the days when everybody would smoke a lot of reefer and go watch Reefer Madness.
Yes, and actually we do have that as a point of pride. Our founder, Keith Stropp, was the one who managed to dig the original recording of Reefer Madness out of the United States Archives and bring it back for re-release. And we went around to mostly college campuses through the 70s and tied that into part of our promotional events. College kids would come out and you know, watch it as a bit of a comedy film, and then we'd also give them a bit of education on cannabis itself.
Yeah, but my point being that because of all of that attention focused on it, folks started looking at the plant as a pleasant way of getting high, and so they took a plant that had a certain percentage of THC and bred it up to a plant that had a much greater percentage of THC. And whereas, you know, we used to have a lot of cannabis sativa, we graduated to the more potent strains of cannabis indica from the Middle East. And what used to be kind of a light, pleasant high has really become quite inebriating, I guess. I mean,
yes. Well, that change you really began to see, particularly in the 90s, after especially California approved Prop 215 for medical use. We began to finally be able to apply modern technologies to the cultivation of cannabis. Previously, it was grown, you know, particularly like any other plant, outdoors or in some closed rooms, with very little technology involved. But through the 90s, cultivators, both in light of this technology and loosening laws across the country, were able to put more time and investment and work on new strategies for how to cultivate more potent plants, as you said. It's important to note, though, that marijuana is today, by and large, a bit stronger. Previously, through the 70s, we estimate, you know, between 10 to 15% THC in most of the higher quality strains. And today, you know, the highest quality tends to be around 20% THC. But in the end, it still really is marijuana. There is no overdose limit. And what we have found through research and anecdotal studies is that marijuana consumers, they tend to realize the potency of their plant, and they self-regulate on how much they consume. If they have stronger cannabis, they smoke less of it. Mm-hmm. So we've really seen it. Well, that's been a very big talking point in the media about how this isn't your Woodstock weed anymore. It's still really it is stronger, but it's not much of a real problem other than you know, just self-regulating on how much you consume. And that really testifies to why there's a need for a legal market. On the black market, you have no idea the strength or the potency or the quality of the product you're consuming. Now in these legal stores and medical dispensaries, people can go in, they can see right up front how strong this is, how much THC there is, and really make an educated decision on which cannabis would work best for them.
Then there seems to be an obstacle or several obstacles to the complete legalization of marijuana. And one of them, of course, was what you talked about, the Single Convention Treaty. We are bound by treaty, I think, and that treaty, the conditions of that treaty supersedes anything we might want to do here in like California or Illinois or wherever. We're bound by that treaty, are we not?
Well, yes, in theory we are, but you're beginning to see as that this treaty ultimately doesn't have a whole lot of teeth or enforcement aspects to it. Particularly, we're beginning to see international movement against the war on drugs. Uruguay, for example, just moved to legalize marijuana in their country, the first country to do so across the board.
Are they a signatory to the Single Convention Treaty?
They are a signatory to the Single Convention Treaty. And, you know, we've long had the Netherlands who operated on a position of tolerance towards cannabis use. And other states, particularly in South America, are really beginning to look towards moving towards legalization, including Colombia and Mexico. Mm-hmm. So especially as soon as Colorado and Washington moved forward, I think the international community kind of took a double take and was like, well, the United States is going to start treating this a little bit more sensibly. I think there's room for us to act. And as reformers, we do have hope. In 2016 in New York, the United Nations will be reconvening again to revise some of their treaties. And that would be our next opportunity to really revise that single Convention on Narcotics Treaty and hopefully remove marijuana from it so countries and states in the United States can move forward trying their own policies on that regard.
Good. And what about the big business interests that don't want to see the competition? You mentioned newspapers and the wood industry, but I'm sure that there are other industries that, you know, perhaps the alcohol industry doesn't want any kind of competition. Perhaps the drug industries don't want people discovering new unregulated forms of drugs that people could take to ameliorate their suffering of one kind or another. What about the big business interests that were really, you know, stood behind the prohibition in the first place?
Mm-hmm. Well, that really evolved over time as well. Our opposition has changed faces several times. You know, in the 30s it was those the Hearsts and the paper companies. And now in modern times, what you're seeing left of the organized opposition really comes down to about three or four major groups. And that's namely drug treatment centers, who are apparently making massive profits off of drug courts that basically give people arrested with marijuana the choice between going to jail or going to treatment, which, is, in my opinion, is a pretty easy choice to make if you're faced with that.
Yeah.
So they're seeing a lot of people being diverted immediately from the court system, and that's really burgeoning their numbers and their profits. Also, the drug testing industry. Drug testing is, by and large, testing against marijuana because all other substances, harder drugs, are out of your system within about 24 to 48 hours. Okay.
Can you hold that, Eric? We're going to have to take a quick break, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Today we're talking about Cannabis Normalica. What will it be like when we once again sow normal cannabis? You're invited to participate. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. What will happen when we legalize cannabis? Do stay tuned. What do you think is going to happen when we once again sow legal cannabis? Cannabis normalica, it once grew everywhere, now grows almost exclusively in under lights, hidden away. This past week, I heard a commercial real estate broker talking about how in this county in which we live, which is one of the smallest, geographically speaking, one of the smallest counties in the state of California, there are hundreds of warehouses producing marijuana, legally, sort of, in a state that accepts marijuana as being a legal medicine. And two states now accept it as a recreation. 20 states now accept it as being a medicine, and even our president and former Chum Ganger Barack Obama said it's not as bad as booze, so go right ahead. It's, you know, looking into the future, that it's going to be legal. So what on earth is going to happen to us and it when it is legalized? Eric Altieri, Communications Director for the National Organization of Reform of Marijuana Laws, or NORML. Eric, we were talking about some of the barriers that exist before it can be legalized. And I guess, you know, we talked about big business and whatnot. I wonder about attitudes of we the people. Do we still have an attitude of fear and loathing with respect to cannabis?
Absolutely not. And this has been a really stark shift in public opinion that started, you know, as soon as we really entered the 2000s and exploded, you know, in the past 3 years. Most national polls have us sitting around, you know, 50 to 58% support for legalizing marijuana and regulating it like alcohol. Gallup poll, which has tracked this every year since 1969, last year has shown that we were at 58% support nationwide. And when they first started polling that question, that support was only around 11 to 12%. So we certainly have come a long way. And what's more important is really how Americans view the use of marijuana. And we've seen this in polling throughout 2013. Previously, the majority of Americans had viewed the use of marijuana as a moral issue. And in just the past 5 years, we've seen that completely flip. And now a majority of Americans do not view it that way. They view it as not an issue of morality. And that's really begin to change how people think about cannabis, which has led to this really majority support for full legalization, and support for medical marijuana is well through off the charts. Nationwide, it's about 80% to 85%. Support for simple decriminalization is in the upper 70s. the American people, it seems, have really largely made up their minds on cannabis and decided to reject the propaganda of reefer madness, finally.
When you say a moral issue, what exactly do you mean by a moral issue?
Well, you know, whether or not it's an issue of moral turpitude, whether or not using marijuana is a inherently bad act in and of itself, whether it makes you a bad person in the eyes of society. And that's largely worn away. People don't really cast any sort of judgment, particularly on the recreational use of marijuana anymore, at least not in the same way that they had in particularly the 80s, for sure, when we had our opposition was very ferocious.
So that would be kind of be the legacy of the Harry Anslinger era, in which, you know, they ran around saying that those people who consume cannabis or marijuana are inherently bad.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
so we've kind of, you know, through the 60s and 70s or something, it kind of became a joke. And now people are kind of saying, well, let's just get over it and look at where to go next. Let's talk about where to go next, and let's talk about what happens if and when cannabis becomes totally illegal and it's growing everywhere. What is that going to mean? First of all, will it be something that the government controls?
Well, yes. Largely, I think that we'll see a model similar to alcohol, where that states can really set their own policies and how they handle this, and it probably will likely vary state to state the same way our alcohol laws vary. And it's important to note that marijuana is growing everywhere now, and it has in a large part for decades. What we're doing by legalizing it is bringing that growing and that selling above ground out of the black market, putting it in the hands of regulated businesses that are licensed by the state, and we're really beginning to actually control this substance and the commerce in it.
Mm-hmm.
People often talk about marijuana like, oh, well, why are we legalizing this new substance, letting this new industry in? Marijuana has been around for, as we've been talking about, thousands of years, and its use has been prevalent in the United States for decades. Mm-hmm. Well, this isn't something new. We're not creating a new thing here. We're controlling something that already exists and has no regulations whatsoever on it.
But with all due respects, how do you control a weed that can be growing anywhere, even to the extent that people grow it on a commercial scale in a basement underneath lights? How on earth can the government control something that can be so freely grown?
Well, it certainly should be, if you look at beer, for example, you can brew your own beer and have your own stills in many countries, in many states, but how many people do you know that are beer consumers ultimately put in that time and effort? The process of growing marijuana isn't quite as simple, at least particularly for good quality marijuana, as most people often talk about it. And we know we can regulate that. We've seen in states that have medical programs that allow for home cultivation, as well as Colorado, where anyone over the age of 21 can cultivate up to 6 plants. It's something that we should allow for. And it ultimately, as we've seen in experience, some people will choose to do it, but most people would much rather pay for the convenience of simply going down to the local legalized marijuana store and purchasing it over the counter.
Do you think that should that be the case, that cannabis will then become as plentiful as zucchini?
Well, certainly not zucchini, but probably certainly more in line of you know, beer and wine. It does have a impact on your mental state. It alters your consciousness a bit. So, you know, it's not zucchini, but it's also not as dangerous as alcohol is to the end user. So we should need to find a balance to regulate it that way, where we acknowledge that this is a psychoactive substance that needs a degree of control, but I don't think that we ultimately need to really we need to be wary of over-regulation of the substance that isn't incredibly dangerous. It does have relatively few harms associated with it, but those can be easily mitigated through regulation and treating those problem users with a public health approach as opposed to a criminal justice one.
But of course, you know, the recreational use of cannabis is only one use of it, and traditionally a very, very minor use of it. Traditionally, there were many other uses that were much more important, because in essence, cannabis, you know, the fiber in the cannabis plant was one of the things that quite literally held the world together. What's going to happen when cannabis is legal and we're allowed to explore all of these other hundreds of different uses?
Well, that's the important move towards legalization, particularly in regards to those who use it for medicinal purposes. What we've been seeing nationwide when it comes to medical marijuana laws is that progressively with each state that approves them, they're getting stricter and stricter. They're removing conditions that qualify, they're removing home cultivation, they're very limiting on the strains and quality of marijuana that can be sold. And ultimately, that's leading to people who could otherwise be benefiting from its medical use to not be able to do so. For example, in D.C., the program's been in operation now for over about a year, and there's only 100 patients enrolled in the program. So to move towards where we can legalize for anyone of a certain age, it really allows people for any purpose, regardless if it's for PTSD or for a concert on Friday night, to be able to make educated decisions, buy the cannabis that works for them, and explore its potential. And it would also open up the ability for medical research and industrial research to really commence, because currently federally with the being scheduled
one. Okay, we're going to have to take a quick break. Right back. Eric Elitier and you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with Eric Elitier, the Communications Director for the National Organization of Reform of Marijuana Laws. A great story, this cannabis stuff. It's been with us for so long. It's, you know, for all, most of us, our living memory. We've been fighting this wicked weed, which is not so wicked anymore. Matter of fact, our president and former tomb ganger Barack Obama says it's not as bad as booze. So that's not bad, right? Booze, we drink a lot of booze and smoke a lot of reefer. But where is this all going to take us, do you think? What's going to happen when cannabis becomes cannabis normalica and is part of our day-to-day life? Erica, a quick question along the way. What do you think this is all going to take us?
Well, I think hopefully this is all leading ultimately to the end of our nationwide prohibition on marijuana, which has largely cost us over $1 trillion over the past 40 years, and it failed to achieve any of its stated goals of lowering use rates, keeping it out of the hands of minors, and really promoting safer communities. Through the legalization of marijuana across the country, we can really begin to keep this out of the hands of our youth, reallocate our law enforcement resources towards violent crime, and also reap substantial tax revenue from a black market that is currently funding violent criminal and gangs across the country.
Do you see cannabis becoming a major commodity in agriculture?
I do, because in many ways it already is. Particularly in California, marijuana is the number one cash crop by most estimates, and it's currently, most of that money is not going into state coffers. It's not coming back in the form of tax revenue. It's simply funding violent and criminal elements in the society. We can take that money away from these gangs, and we can put that towards good use, such in Colorado, where a lot of that revenue is going to go towards new school construction and education of our youth, instead of being kind of thrown away on a market that already exists, but we were trying to really squash, but have never done so successfully.
Okay, folks, what do you think is going to happen? What will happen when cannabis becomes cannabis normalica and a regular part of our lives? Let's start with Joe. Joe, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hi.
Hi.
I believe this guy is talking a bunch of bogus stuff. No offense to him, but bogus, because A, I've been a pothead since I was 2 years old. Okay.
Since two.
And I'll tell you what, legalization of marijuana is a joke. Okay, the joke, because of the fact that now you can get DUIs, which gives the cops more criminal activity against a marijuana smoker. Then, not only that, but if you get on the internet, you can go marijuana cigarettes. First company to come up is Marlboro. They've already got a patent on it. They're already chemicalizing it, getting ready for the public to have chemical marijuana, just like cigarettes.
Well,
yay.
Okay, Joe. So why is it bogus?
Well, it needs to be decriminalized, not legalized, decriminalized. Because legalized means they can put laws on it. Decriminalized means that it can go on your table as an oregano or salt. What, are we going to put laws against salt next and oregano and say, oh, well, these things do this to your body?
Let's try that out on Eric Altieri. Eric, what do you think? legalize or decriminalize? Thanks for the call, Joe.
Well, he's certainly overlooking a really key aspect here. When we decriminalize marijuana possession alone, and we allow individuals to not be prosecuted criminally for just simple possession, that's a good start. It helps end our arrests. But what that doesn't address is the criminal black market. These individuals are still going to have to obtain their marijuana from somewhere. And while if we don't provide them with an above-board place to purchase these products, they're going to continue to go to the black market, and that money will continue to be funneled to criminal elements.
Well, do you think the black market will disappear with legalization? I mean, the black market, there's still a black market for booze. People still make money by making their own booze and selling it. Won't they do that with a cannabis as well?
Well, that's an incredibly small market, and it constitutes a very, very infinitely small percentage of actual booze sales in this country. I don't think we'll see a criminal black market persist for very long. And that will really land on the balance of taxation. We need to be able to tax marijuana at a rate that we can fund the programs for its regulation, but also so that we don't overcharge for the product that people return to the black market.
Okay.
And I think that most.
Dan, what do you think?
Well, I have a comment and a question. Eric, I think you're doing a fine job. Can Eric hear me?
Yeah.
I knew the first time I got high in the 60s, the government was lying to me. And I have never trusted the government from that day to this. And I'm reading Robert McNamara's autobiography. He's a former Secretary of Defense in Vietnam. He admitted that the premise for going to war with Vietnam, the Gulf of Tonkin incident, was a lie. And that's the other reason I don't trust the government. And I have a question. I think I remember earlier this year signing a petition to legalize growing hemp. Michael, maybe you even know about that.
Well, there's always petitions going around for hemp.
I think Eric, maybe help me with this. I think a subsection of that was to release all the potheads from jail. I have a friend who spent several months in jail for delivering legal pot, and I didn't like that.
Well, okay, Eric, thank you for the call, Dan. Really appreciate it. Eric, what about all the people in jail? And I guess that's kind of like a subset of what Dan was asking, but what about all the people in jail for cannabis?
Certainly, and that's beginning to become more of an issue in states that are moving towards legalization. In Washington State last year, after their approval of I-502, they introduced a bill in the House that ultimately wasn't approved last session, but very well will come back, that would expunge the record for previous marijuana offenses. That's definitely something we really need to be very conscious of and work towards. If we agree now that marijuana use shouldn't be a crime, we shouldn't be saddling all these people who were previously convicted.
Okay, good. Nick, are you there? Go ahead.
Yeah.
Fire away.
Where we're at now is we got our governor, Jerry Brown, in California. He vetoed twice opportunities to grow hemp. And where we are at now is we're at the driest time in the where it's drought tolerant. What changed Jerry Brown? He would have 5 pounds as a mayor, and that was advanced at its time. Eric, a couple of
really quickly, what's your question?
You brought up the entities that were suppressing the efforts, and I got a clarity about two. The EPA hasn't been touched because of the control, but can you go back and recap the five entities that are basically hindering progress?
Okay, we'll pick that up when we get back from the break. Thanks for the call, Nick. Tom will pick up when we get back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Eric Altieri. The question is, where do we go when hemp or cannabis or whatever you want to call it becomes legal? Cannabis normalica. Will it be like it was in the past, grown by the millions of acres throughout the United States? Will it be something that's tightly controlled by the federal government and only those who pay taxes can have it? What do you think? 831-479-1080, 800-624-2665. Right back. Well, caller Nick brought up a very interesting point with respect to politicians. He said that when Jerry Brown was mayor of Oakland, California, he said people should all be able to have their own pot, 5 plants or 5 pounds or something. Now, as governor, Governor Jerry Brown says people should not be able to grow hemp. So, and then the president of the United States says, oh, well, this stuff is not as bad as booze, so what's the big fuss? So I got to thinking, I don't know anything that drives politicians as loopy as cannabis. Eric Altieri, why is that?
Well, by nature, politicians are extremely cautious animals, and particularly for a long time on the Democratic side of this issue, they were concerned with being kind of cast as soft on crime if they were to come out and take any stance of lessening marijuana penalties. But with the onslaught of public opinion, we're beginning to finally see major party politicians, both those running for office and those in office, finally beginning to come around and talk about this issue sensibly.
Okay. Tom, can you talk about this issue sensibly?
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, the question I've always had with this is, if they legalize it, and here, just take it close to home, I'm an employer, and I happen to see one of my guys on his, you know, it's his time, free time, he's at home or something, I happen to notice he's smoking a joint. And I know that in 3 or 4 hours, he's got to report for the night shift to try forklifting the cooler. What's my responsibility and obligation as an employer once it's legalized?
Ooh.
What do I do with that?
Eric?
Yes. Well, currently in the states that have legalized, and it certainly doesn't look like it'll change anytime soon, employers will still have the right to fire employees or penalize employees for on-site consumption or inebriation the same way they can currently if someone were to show up drunk to their job. But what we really need is to be able to effectively engage impairment. The issue does arise with marijuana that it remains in your system for quite a long time. So we need to, if you can focus on whether or not they're impaired on the job, employers will still be empowered to
do something about it. Eric, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you all out there for tuning in the Food Chain. Remember, the third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't. Thank you, Eric.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.